Good evening. Welcome to this event on the theme of filming the body in crisis, trauma, hope, and healing. My name is Caroline Bainbridge. It's a great pleasure for me this evening to have been invited to introduce Davina as she gives a reading from her very excellent and wonderful new book, which has the same title as the event, and which I believe there are a couple of copies downstairs if any of you are hot-footing it to the shop later on. You can buy it there. It's also available online via the Palgrave Macmillan website and Amazon. Other booksellers are also available. I have prepared a lovely introduction for Davina, and I trusted my electronic gadgetry not to let me down, and it's deleted itself. So please bear with me as I extemporize a little. This is a wonderful book, which I cannot recommend to you highly enough. It's beautifully written, but it's also highly evocative of a kind of positionality and perspective that's emerging in feminist film scholarship that I think is really important. Davina's book is not offering a simple thesis. It's a work of love, I think, and one which I've discovered today has evolved over a long period of time. And I think its evolution and its careful history, its careful making, really reveals itself in the text. It's one of the most engaging and emotionally touching books I've read for a long time. Davina writes not just about one national mode of cinema, nor does she write about one particular director, nor does she pick up on one particular trope of cinema, or preoccupy herself with the politics of cinema and distribution and the politics of film scholarship around that. Instead, this book looks at a very diverse array of filmmakers, ranging from Steve McQueen through Chris Marker to Christopher Nolan, Atom Egoyan, Jim Jarmusch, Ingmar Bergman. In some, for me, of the most moving and evocative sections, she also deals with the work of female filmmakers, such as Samira Makhmalbaf, Lucille Hajalilovic, I think I've said her name properly, Claire Denis, a number of other people. And in this regard, I think there's a clear line of Davina's developing scholarship and presence as a leading light in discussions around feminine cinema and cinema in the feminine, and the importance of colonizing a space to evoke aspects of femininity, which is also present in the theoretical framing of this book, which draws very beautifully on the work of Melanie Klein and the importance of an embodied relationship both to the world but also to our emotional experience of the world. So Davina picks up on a number of different tropes of contemporary but also recent, more historical cinema to signal the ways in which embodied experience of cinema offers a new perspective on the endless images of trauma that we seem to see on our screens all the time. So Davina makes a compelling case, I think, for pausing a moment on images of trauma to think about the way in which the traumatic pain is entwined with hope. And here she draws on Klein in a very, very innovative way to speak back to the phenomenological frame of recent film philosophy and to make a case for a psychoanalytic intervention into the film philosophical debates so that we can think about the uses that we make of cinema as an object, the opportunities that cinema provides us for reparation, for recovery, and also for a rejuvenated sense of self and identity. And I think she does this in a way that is extremely evocative, very, very poignant, deeply, deeply moving, and in a way that sets her up as a leading light in the world of film philosophy and psychoanalytic perspectives today. So it's a great pleasure for me to introduce her and to hand over to her. She's going to read from her book around Cronenberg's work, but she takes us in many different directions as she does so. We'll have time at the end for some questions and discussion, so please do try to hold on to your thoughts, and we'll come back to you later on. Please welcome Davina Quinlivan.
Okay, Okay, so first of all, I'd like to thank Caroline very much for that really lovely introduction. That was really kind and generous. Thank you so much. And also to Lily Spain, I don't know if Lily's still here, just to thank her for organising this event and for allowing me to come here and speak today. It's such a privilege and so strange as well to be here in Freud's house. So actually I thought it would be rather apt that I drew on the chapter from the book that specifically focuses on quite a few films, but precisely Cronenberg's recent, well, quite recent film, A Dangerous Method, which is about the relationship between Jung, Freud and Sabina Spielrein, and also around the notions of psychiatry and trauma within cinema. So actually this is a chapter that's certainly apt for our setting, but also it's one of the chapters in the book that isn't just necessarily entrenched in the methodology and the theory around what my overarching argument that's looking at Klein, as Caroline just said, in relation to what film theory is currently doing and around object relations theory as well. So hopefully this will be illuminating and offer insight into what I'm doing with the book, but also will open up a space for questions later in relation to how cinema represents certain ideas and the narrative within these films, as well as more broader questions about healing and recovery. Okay, so this chapter is actually chapter 5, and the title's called Cronenberg's Cure, A Dangerous Method, Spider, and the Spectre of Psychosis in the Lost Explorer. So I'll be looking at these three film pieces in particular, but also be looking at lots of other films along the way. So the opening titles of Cronenberg's A Dangerous Method unfold as a series of dark waves and intricate lines indicating a succession of inky, handwritten inscriptions lightly traced over a papery surface. The slashes of black ink seem to vibrate, elongated as vertical shivers, while the softly textured surface they move across is partially eclipsed by dark grey shadows. On the soundtrack, deep, rich chords resonate from a cello and other stringed instruments, embodying a highly suggestive and ominous, unsettling harmony, which is both elegant and disturbing. The indelible hieroglyphs which move in waves across the screen are portentous of the film's deciphering of its subjects and, in turn, their professional, lifelong interest in unravelling the troubled minds of others. While A Dangerous Method's pen and ink titles reveal to the viewer the crux of the narrative of Cronenberg's film, which centres on the triangular relationship fostered via written correspondences between Sigmund Freud, played by Viggo Mortensen, Carl Jung, played by Michael Fassbender, and Sabina Spielrein, played by Keira Knightley, who is the first successful recipient of Jung's Talking Cure. This distortion is created from the frequent close-ups of the inked words, invariably calling to mind the Rorschach blots, famously aligned with psychoanalysis and the hidden unconscious. Indeed, Cronenberg has already actively employed the motif of the Rorschach blots during the opening titles of his 2003 feature, Spider, a film whose protagonist, played by Ralph Fiennes, struggle with schizophrenia is foreshadowed by its opening imagery, monochrome, spidery shapes and textures, alternating from large ink stains to sculptural indentations. While the psychic terror experienced by Spider's protagonist made itself manifest in the subtle texture and tonality of the film, the explicit focus on the very subject of psychoanalysis and its rooting in the pioneering experiments of Freud and Jung leads to a far more controlled and rigorous exploration of the fragile interstices which might exist between rationality, desire, and repression in A Dangerous Method. So, this portion of the book is principally concerned with the figuration of psychological disorder, the healing mind and body of Cronenberg's The Dangerous Method, and the cinematic adaptation of Patrick McGrath's The Lost Explorer, directed by Tim Walker, and McGrath's gothic novel, Spider. Especially in the context of McGrath's father's work as a psychiatrist at Broadmoor Hospital. So I'm concerned most with the expression of the narrative strands in these works, which articulate striking questions in relation to psychiatry, mental illness, and also, importantly, the cinematic qualities of such films, bringing to the surface the visceral experience of psychic trauma. So A Dangerous Method and Spider, to a great extent, represent a new stage in Cronenberg's body of work, which moves away from the graphic, violent portrayals of human physicality and transformation, famously originated in his film The Fly, of course, as well as Scanners, Videodrome, and Dead Ringers. These films operate within a similar strata to those of his body horror movies, but crucially represent a move towards the interiority of the subjects, penetrating the flesh in order to explore the psychology of human existence. With a corpus of work spanning over 30 years, Cronenberg is well known for his thematic exploration of the modern condition and his questioning of what it means to be a technological entity as well as a sexual subject. Bodies and minds in crisis, radically altered or in flux. For Ashley Allenson, Cronenberg's contribution to the Canadian film industry has also, quote, worked to revise policy, found and fund production teams and companies, and deal with sensibilities that are not indigenous to Canada itself, but rather to the cinematic rhetoric of the country's first auteur. His trajectory has moved from original features masked by convention to revisions of literary adaptations, accentuated with personal zeal, culminating in a body of works that are body-centric, end quote. So he's drawn to the concept of metamorphosis, to the transgression of heteronormative identity, in which cultural anxieties about sexuality, sexual difference, and the physicality of modern life are monstrously made flesh. His later films, for example, Spider, A History of Violence, and Eastern Promises, have tended to avoid his characteristic body horror motifs. They seem to represent a more evolved, nuanced, and complex facet of corporeal anxiety and malevolence, first explored in earlier films such as Naked Lunch, Madame M. Butterfly, Crash, and Dead Ringers. Freud, Jung, and Spielrein are reborn as Cronenbergian entities, sinewy and physically perfect, yet unsettling as taught, disciplined intellectuals struggling to break free of social constraints. If The Fly underscored the primal aspects of humanity which lurked beneath the veneer of social order, then Spielrein, the female ingenue at the heart of A Dangerous Method, undergoes a similar transformation, only this time it is mental illness which is monstrous. The Dangerous Method offers a study of psychoanalysis rather than historical biopic, which conceives of the discipline as an infectious addiction, like the deadly cathode rays in Videodrome, or the video games plugged into the spinal cords of gamers in his film Existence. While Spielrein's recovery proves that psychoanalysis is an effective science, her sexual desire remains fixed on the pleasures which had been the source of her mental breakdown, her father's sexual abuse, and its pivotal intertwining with her sexual maturation. Jung embarks upon an indulgent sadomasochistic affair with Spielrein, while Freud is implicated in the machinations of its progression and conclusion. Jung, in particular, embodies the concept of psychoanalysis as a corrosive entity which threatens to also engulf Freud and Spielrein. The Freudian concept of the ego is then contextualized as the site of willing contamination through Cronenberg's representation of the three protagonists and their struggle to define themselves while depending on each other in various ways for survival. The subject matter and the meticulous research that is evident throughout Cronenberg's film owes much to the involvement of Christopher Hampton, whose play The Talking Cure provides the source material for the film. Hampton adapted The Talking Cure with Cronenberg and much of its stringent and subtly comedic dialogue remaining. Overall, the film may be best encountered as a development from the filmmaker's earlier examinations of shifting psychical and physical boundaries, transgression, and the fear of becoming strangers to ourselves. In Spider, Cronenberg gestures towards the inner life of his Samuel Beckett-esque protagonist, drawing attention to peeling wallpaper, hieroglyphic marks on walls and notepads, nicotine-stained fingertips, and wide-angle shots of gas towers, which strangely seem to channel Louise Bourgeois' giant spider sculpture, affectionately named Mammal. Similarly, when Jung seeks out Spielrein in her room at the clinic, he brushes his hands over her personal artifacts, letters and objects, as if suddenly reminded of the contact he craves from Spielrein through the intimate evocation of her daily rituals and obsessions. The clinic, too, is shot obliquely in order to emphasise its austere spaces, phantasmatic zones, like the interiors of Spider or the cars in Crash. More broadly, Cronenberg's film also reminds us of Freud's impact on earlier film narratives, including the melodrama genre in which analysts were first represented on screen. For example, while Betty Davis is helped to find herself and transform into a social butterfly by a Freudian in Irving Rapper's 1942 film Now Voyager, an intellectual monster is sculpted in the shape of Dr. Hannibal Lecter in The Silence of the Lambs. Psychoanalytic discourse has also dominated the scholarly analysis of film ever since Laura Mulvey's seminal 1976 essay, Visual Pleasure and Narrative Cinema, in which the Freudian theorization of sexual difference and patriarchal ideology served as the foundation for the viewer's identification with male subjects and their acknowledgement of female subjects as visual objects in classical Hollywood cinema, especially in the films of Alfred Hitchcock. Indeed, Mulvey's essay remains the cornerstone, especially of all undergraduate studies in film. Through its depiction of psychiatry and the very lives of the psychiatrists responsible for the development of psychoanalysis, A Dangerous Method reminds us of the intricate links between creative endeavour and the scientific and the science of cinematic experimentation. A Dangerous Method opens with an unnerving jolt to the nervous system, with several disturbing images of Spielrein being admitted to a Swiss clinic, in which most of the film is set. While Knightley's body remains intact, her psychic pain is conveyed through a series of contortions and jerks, similar to those suggested by Edvard Munch in his piece, his painting The Scream. Through an alternating succession of medium shots and close-ups, we view Spielrein arching her shoulders into strained angles and tensing her jaw muscles, while her hair, a fringe of lank waves, hangs in diagonal streaks across her face and over the starched white ruffles of her high-collared blouse. Behind the glass of the coach, which carries her to the clinic, we view her face pressed up to the window, screaming while her agile limbs rock its exquisite painted wooden frame. She is everything that her clasp forbids, a most unladylike and monstrous entity, unwilling to conform to the expectations of her gender. Indeed, Knightley's usually lovely, elegant, and girlish features are so irrevocably contorted, her chin and cheeks stretched into exaggerated angles, that she bears little resemblance to her other corseted roles in well-known films such as Pride and Prejudice and The Duchess. As Peter Bradshaw puts it, Sabina's lower jaw is shoved out what looks like a couple of feet with a lower row of teeth jutting jaggedly upwards, like Ridley Scott's Alien when it comes out of John Hurt's stomach. Cronenberg suggests that the tortured physicality of Knightley's performance emphasises the outward expression of her illness, which remains historically gendered, because she's suffering from hysteria. They kind of, he says, quote, "They were kind of mutilating themselves by penalizing themselves and deforming their bodies and folding down and laughing hysterically and so on. If it was a disease, it seems not to exist anymore. The word hysteria comes from the Greek word which means uterus, and it was considered to be a disease of women. And in fact, they used to remove the uteruses in women in order to cure this disease, which I now think we might see as resulting from the repression of women in terms of their intellect and their sexuality." End quote. Cronenberg has always implied that the mind and body suffer equally. But here, as we watch Schwerin convulse and later learn of her fascination with psychoanalysis, it is clear that the director has turned his attention to the discipline itself as yet another dangerous disease whose tantalizing power lies in liberating the repressed. Through treatment, Spielraum is visibly released from her suffering, slowly metamorphosing into a differently composed and controlled young woman, now compelled by a different passion. Her drive to learn more about the ideas which then lead to her cure, and its culmination in her sadomasochistic sexual relationship with Jung. In an alchemic intermingling of her masochistic desire and the position of vulnerability that her role as Jung's patient affords her, Spielrein embarks on a sexual affair with her psychiatrist, characterized by his beating of her over a bed. While these scenes might be understood as the final victimization of Spielrein, now the object of sexual desire and no longer the speaking subject of the narrative, they seem to be much more intertwined with her complicated affirmation and rebirth as a survivor of a traumatic and abusive childhood. While Jung's therapy does not help her, their sexual relationship seems to offer a much more revelatory and intoxicating form of release, a cure which asserts her self-expression and sexual freedom. In one of the sexual encounters filmed between Jung and Spielrein, we see her body in a white corset and full-length petticoats, her poised profile dominating over half of the image in an S shape framed by the wooden windows of her apartment. Jung is glimpsed in the distance, partially obscured by the edge of the window, turned towards us yet remaining in the shadows. Spielrein's entire body is arched, but unlike the contorted physicality we witnessed during the film's opening sequence, her body is now smoothed into a softened wave of movement. And with every jolt, as Jung's hand slaps her, we are reminded of the shivering, inky lines of the film's titles. Her body is vibrating with intensity and a light. The vertical lines of the windows, the striped wallpaper, and even Jung's black braces are picked out against the white folds of Spielrein's undergarments, emphasizing further the contrasting curves of her back, her cleavage, and the softness of her arms as they stretch out over the bed frame. Through such aesthetic formulations and contrivances, Cronenberg seems to privilege Spielrein's liberating experience of masochism, the mechanism of delay, suspension, and release, and its ecstatic conclusion, which alters her mind and body forever. In her book Female Masochism in Film, Ruth McPhee draws attention to erotic experience and sensual forms of corporeality contextualized precisely through female masochism as a mobilizing and generative form of self-expression. For McPhee, the concept of masochism in film opens up questions relating to the role of what she calls unpleasure and the ways in which it might anchor our deepest sense of joy. Quote, masochism is positioned as exterior to the reproductive aim so cherished by Western society and politico-economic doctrines. Instead of progressing towards the end point of sexual pleasure and the completion of satisfaction, it thrives on scenarios of suspense and delay, eschewing the genital zones in favour of more dispersive realms of the body. End quote. McPhee's delineation of unpleasure as a possible source of goodness corresponds with Cronenberg's cinematic portrayal of Spielrein's masochistic drive. His film strongly emphasizes the liberating powers of female masochism, rejecting the ideological inflections of romance which would otherwise firmly remain fixed on Spielrein's fulfillment as purely Jung's love interest. In particular, McPhee's fascinating analysis of Schoenberg's Lynchian S&M romance Secretary, starring Maggie Gyllenhaal, emphasises the positive implications of cinema's gendered representation of masochism. In this sense, Secretary's heroine, Lee, bears comparison with Cronenberg's affirmative depiction of Spielrein. For McPhee, Schoenberg's film is, quote, a redemptive narrative of self-harm that is grounded in notions of healing and recovery, end quote. A Dangerous Method addressed similar notions, but through the very context of psychoanalysis and its most prominent figures. Furthermore, what is most striking about Cronenberg's film is that it appears to be about Spielrein's cure through Jung's analysis, but in actuality, it focuses much more on her sexuality and the pivotal moment in which her trauma is exorcised through masochistic sex. Her ultimate rejection of Jung confirms that it is the act itself which is important to her rather than any attachment to him. Certainly, as Peter Bradshaw points out in his review of the film, she has galvanised, if not precisely being cured, by being taken on as Jung's lover. The centrality of Spielrein's subjectivity is further emphasised through Peter Suschitzky's cinematography during all the sex scenes which take place with Jung. Most noticeably, the sequence which features Spielrein on the bed with her body framed by the window of the apartment positions her in a way that calls attention to her gaze. While Jung's face is almost entirely obscured, her gratification and pleasure is unmistakably brought to the foreground of the image. More precisely, Spielrein's profile fills the lower right half of the shot composition, arguably the most important area within the image which our eye naturally moves towards. If Spielrein's body possesses kinship with the wavy, pulsating columns of ink recalling the letters passed between herself, Freud and Jung, then the profile of her ecstatic face is like a punctuation mark, the culminating point her whole body moves towards. While her gaze is important here, other elements of the mise-en-scène also point towards the fact that this sequence is centred on her subjectivity and the viewer's identification with her. The framing contours of the window through which we glimpse Spielrein and Jung might be seen to corroborate a voyeuristic gaze, but Suschitzky's precise incorporation of it within the mise-en-scène draws more attention to the location we inhabit. This is, of course, Spielrein's apartment and her territory, a place where she is entirely free, unlike the pallor of the olive green and grey walls of Jung's clinic, or the claustrophobic coach she is first seen arriving in. There's also another layer of meaning we can derive from Spielrein's sadomasochistic encounters with Jung. The film is already about a power struggle which exists between Freud, Jung and Spielrein through the prism of their shared interest in psychoanalysis, resulting in what Bradshaw describes as a kind of as triangular patterns of transference, which draw even deeper into a kind of ménage à trois inflected with Oedipal tensions. Spielrein's masochistic sexual pleasure is then both the intensification of these power relations and their simultaneous undoing, revitalising and restoring Spielrein's inner life while also benefiting professionally. As we have seen, filmic and contextual notions of psychiatry and psychosis are embedded in Cronenberg's A Dangerous Method, enabling new strands of inquiry within her aesthetic, within an aesthetic which closely relates to questions of recovery and the healing mind and body of Cronenberg's protagonists. However, his earlier film, Spider, starts to originate such questions through its explicit exploration of schizophrenia and more broadly psychiatry as its possible cure. For Spider, a film which follows the story of a man recently released from a psychiatric hospital, only to fall steadily back into the rituals and habits associated with his illness, he's swept up in a web of spiraling intensity and paranoia. So at this point, I start to shift focus from Cronenberg to the work of the Gothic novelist Patrick McGrath and the cinematic incarnations of his novel Spider and The Lost Explorer, which is a short film directed by Tim Walker. So the subject of psychiatry forges a resonant connection between both filmmaker and writer, shedding light on their respective evocations of psychic trauma and their envisioning of catharsis. Above all, an investigation of McGrath must begin with his personal connection to Broadmoor, the real lived space which haunts every fragment of his work, including Spider. So I'm going to start talking a little bit about Broadmoor and about its shadow in McGrath's work before I start to talk about Spider and The Lost Explorer. There is a red keep high above the village of Crowthorne, Berkshire, buried within a forest in which tall trees entomb it. The bones of the building seem to vibrate like stifled breaths, a strange and kinetic rumble. Occasionally, the whirring noise reaches a crescendo and metamorphoses into an intermittent scream, so loud it can be heard for miles across several towns. At night, the Red Keep is lit up like a constellation of itself, dots of hundreds of lights blinking, perceptible from the roadside. The hum continues through the night while electricity pumps orange, low-level lighting across manicured grounds, playing fields and a little farm. These subtle sounds and their rarer, deafening cries and figurations are beacons of modernity. The Red Keep, in actuality, is a 150-year-old relic, an asylum, and the faint buzz which reverberates through its imposing estate is the sound of an Orwellian web of surveillance. The monthly wailing emitted from the speaker system strategically placed around the surrounding areas is the warning bell, the rehearsal of an alarm system whose air raid style screams confirm actually that the asylum is once again secure. This Red Keep is formerly known as the West London Mental Health Trust, but it is, for many, a site of horror, or rather horrific connotations, owing to its historic containment of the criminally insane. Broadmoor was close to the childhood home of the Gothic horror writer McGrath, and his father's employment at the hospital permitted him access into the inside the inner walls of the estate. Indeed, Broadmoor casts a long shadow over much of his work, directly in terms of his broaching of the issue of psychiatry as a trope within his oeuvre and as an embodiment of strangeness, an extraordinary environment moored to the everyday world of Crowthorne. Its name alone conjures all sorts of Gothic imagery of some kind of rugged vista or dank, marshy harbour, but nothing can come close to the real thing and its topography, its zone of containment, stasis and threat. McGrath's father was a medical superintendent at Broadmoor, the very reason why this monumental place is etched into the fabric of McGrath's writing, especially his book Asylum, which features a psychiatrist working at a remote hospital. Spider's story of schizophrenia and traumas, his other book, Trauma, and that was adapted into a film, its exploration of post-traumatic stress disorder, narrated by an American psychiatrist, are important here. So it seems everything leads back to Broadmoor. It is much more likely that this Red Keep persists in mooring itself to McGrath's consciousness. One wonders then if Broadmoor just keeps on entwining itself around the narratives he fleshes out on paper, its otherness multiplied and enlarged. Broadmoor is a maximum security hospital founded in 1863, and its listed architecture is astonishing. It was designed to be deliberate, within deliberate close proximity to everyday life, a gesture which rejects the stigma associated with mental illness. Acceptance and normativity neatly represented by its discreet positioning near the villages of Crowthorne and Sandhurst. Yet despite its nestling within a few feet of the Victorian High Street, it exists entirely within its own eerie realm, islanded by fields and hidden within thousands of pine trees. It has its own special zone, signalled not only by the low hum of electrical activity which ensures it is impregnable, but by its stillness and beauty. It is not uncommon to see locals walking up to its walls with children and dogs in tow, drawn to its stately environment and the meadows it resides in. The estate itself also borders Wildmoor, a dry lowland heath and valley bog, whose habitat contains unusual varieties of plants and birds. If approached via the top of the high street, the hill which leads up towards Wildmoor leads straight into the path of the trees, like looming gatekeepers shivering at new arrivals. At this height, it is even possible to see deer within the outer perimeters of the hospital. So this coupling of the pastoral and the everyday with a more phantasmatic reality offers up an acute sense of texture and duality characteristic of McGrath's work. For me, this is especially summed up by that walk into Crowthorne at Upper Broadmoor Road, moving from the very banal and innocuously pretty ghost town to the high red walls and the trees in which one is immediately possessed by a kind of wonder and ambivalent fascination. While some of its inhabitants might suffer from mental disorders which blur the lines between fantasy and reality, the institution they are confined to is a place of unrealness, a manifestly surreal and otherworldly zone with its own sense of temporality and spatiality. The deer living in the estate are like spectres of McGrath's work, an outward and uncanny reflection of otherness constantly escaping our grasp. The fallow deer lend the grounds of Broadmoor a beguiling kind of animality which might call to our archaic and primal selves. In this sense, Broadmoor's DNA can be traced throughout McGrath's work, especially in Spider and The Lost Explorer. Here, nature plays a significant part in Cronenberg and Walker's films, and its alchemic role in McGrath's unique style of Gothic literature is rare and powerful. Both films feature shallow graves, makeshift burials, sodden earth. Spiders and birds are ciphers for the humans in each story. As with much of McGrath's psychological narratives, the horror is in the detail. In Cronenberg's harrowing adaptation of McGrath's Spider, the visuality of the film formally emphasises web-like imagery and the physicality of the world he inhabits in order to tell the story of a mentally ill man coming to terms with the murder of his own mother. He murdered her by gassing, he gassed her using an elaborate series of wiry threads to release the gas switch on the oven. And in this context, a wide-angled, looming shot of a large gas tower with its crisscross steelwork is powerfully charged. While a defunct gas fireplace is also an object of terror, the invisible smell of gas torments the protagonist, imagined everywhere, in his hair, on his skin. Synonymous with the body horror genre, Cronenberg employs a fleshy colour palette of beige, brown and grey, highlighting the sinewy body of his protagonist and the twine he uses to make webs. His hands are all ashen fingernails, filth and lined, red knuckles. We see yellowing skin stained by cigarettes. In one scene, we see his torso scrubbed and pallid, bound by twine, not only a spider making webs, but now resembling a fly or the spider's bait. Spider is perpetually entrapped in his own mesh of deception, distortion and paranoia. This is an extract from McGrath's novel, where he writes, "When did it all start to go sour? When did it start to die? There was a time when we were happy. I suppose the decay was gradual, a function of poverty and monotony and the sheer grim dinginess of those narrow streets and alleys. Drink, too, played its part, and so did my father's character, his innately squalid nature, the deadness that was inside him and that came in time to infect my mother and me like some sort of contagious disease." So thus, Cronenberg may be best known for his obsession with infectious bodies, but Spider is not a horror movie, per se, in this vein. It's simply consumed by the experience of horror. The protagonist is deeply tormented by some kind of subconscious terror, fragile and hopeless. Images of yellowing and peeling wallpaper are prevalent. There are also derelict houses, creaking floorboards, which contribute to the texture of the film's fractured identity. and also Spider's state of mind. Furthermore, his mental illness is only explicitly acknowledged in earlier scenes when he is at hospital being assessed. We come to know his character through his everyday reckoning with the terror that haunts him. Unlike the film, McGrath's book is told through Spider's perspective, and his framing of this through the character's obsession with writing intimately connects us with his stream of consciousness. While Cronenberg makes up for this through the intimate aesthetic of his film, McGrath's words suggestively capture the kind of verbal and psychic disturbance associated with mental illness. He writes, "All is quiet in the attic now, and my terror has abated to some extent. My relationship to this book is changing. When I began to write, I intended to record the conclusions I'd arrived at about the events of the autumn and winter of my 13th year. And in the process, I thought I'd buttress and support myself, shore up my shaky identity. For since being discharged, I have not been strong. But all this has changed. I write now to control the terror that comes when the voices start up in the attic. They have grown worse, you see, much worse. And it is only with the flow of my own words that I am able to block out the clamour of theirs." The opening title, The Spider, also betray McGrath's childhood experiences of clinical psychology absorbed while at Broadmoor. Rorschach blots dissolving into and out of each other. We also hear the song, it's a hymn called Love Will Find Out the Way, to the composer Howard Shaw used this piece in order to focus on the melody and also the lyrics, which are about love and loss. Throughout the titles, the varying textures, sharp lines and mottled ink stains are like waves of consciousness. Yet the hymn-like melody emphasises the film's theme of redemption, love and rebirth. Ultimately, Spider offers no resolution, no ultimate redemption, no moment of definite reconciliation. It asks us to imagine the kind of terrors which might break one's soul, to accept this trauma and to its varying states of being a part of humanity, and to rid ourselves of the constant need to rationalise and objectify mental illness. While Spider features a troubled young boy, the fashion photographer Tim Walker made his directorial debut with his short film The Lost Explorer, which is an adaptation of McGrath's short story about a young girl's discovery of an adventurer in her back garden. Here, and this is the last film I'll be speaking about, here the eponymous explorer suffers from malaria and is found hidden in a tangled thicket of evergreens, soothed only by young Evelyn as she brings him food and water. The Lost Explorer is a story which permits McGrath to write about a state of consciousness cut off from its rooting in reality, adrift, afraid, and isolated, much like Spider's protagonist. McGrath is adept here at cultivating our perception of tormented souls, intimate, highly emotive, and visceral. Its film adaptation not only enhances the misty, dreamlike tonality of McGrath's vivid imagery, it also invites complex questions about a child's sense of morality and responsibility. In other words, care, through its embellished, highly evocative portrayal of the explorer's companion, the young Evelyn. In Walker's film, the explorer is seen to cling on to Evelyn as his only hope and source of comfort, mistaken in the fog of malaria for his beloved Agatha. But she is no ordinary little girl. She blithely collects objects such as a pickled thumb and her father's black revolver, which holds a dark fascination for her. For her, the explorer is a different kind of object, a piece of archaeology which she will return to the earth sooner than she had expected. The Lost Explorer offers reflection on the role of the female child as protector and guardian of the male adults, a narrative trope which also may be seen in films such as The Spirit of the Beehive, which is The Fall, and Whistle Down the Wind. In order to appreciate the significance of The Lost Explorer, it's useful to look at Victor Arisa's film The Spirit of the Beehive in a little bit more detail. Set in Francoist Spain, Victor Arisa's seminal film tells the story of Anna, whose world is irrevocably altered when she meets a fugitive soldier. Anna's obsession with James Whale's horror film Frankenstein beautifully evokes the naivety of childhood when she refuses to accept the murder of its monster by whom she is fascinated. This innocent perspective also shapes her discovery of the soldier, caring for him while he hides in a sheepfold. Unaware of the threat he poses to her, Anna's experience of the soldier is dangerously enmeshed in her memory of Whale's film and his monster. Like Evelyn in Walker's film, Anna's inner life is delicately composed and fleshed out. The film is filled with oniric, heady images of the farm she lives on, its dusty yellow landscape serving as a potent backdrop to the light-filled daydreams she finds herself lost within. Similarly, Evelyn's country home, its scale and vast open spaces, permits her to roam freely within a distinct with a distinct sense of self-possession. While Walker's film is filled with the noise of the wind or trees rustling, Arise's soundtrack famously contains the sound of Anna's father's beehives rumbling and vibrating like the electricity used to power Frankenstein. Above all, the close-ups of Anna and her open features enable us to connect intimately with her, willing her dreams to live on just a little longer before they are tainted by the savage reality of war. Both Arise's film and Walker's say something not only about the imaginative powers of children, but also foreground their nurturing qualities as we witness Anna's immediate desire to feed and protect the soldier and Evelyn's determination to care for the explorer. Rather like the bees at the heart of Arise's film, the natural world is also summoned through Walker's imagery, which stunningly gives form to one of the explorer's most evocative stories. So at the centre, he recounts a story about a clipper ship whose birds have been released from their cages in order to search for land, which is kind of like a meta-narrative, which serves as a kind of symbol of the explorer himself, his desire for flight, freedom, and selfhood. Walker uses digital effects to evoke the scale and beauty of the clipper ship and the birds, which is like a faint projection of the explorer's story. While he holds Evelyn's hand. In an abandoned parlour, we see the explorer and Evelyn with their backs turned towards us, silently watching something moving about the dust and plaster. There are sails like delicate cobwebs, a masthead and creaking timbers. Shimmering yellow birds perch on the sails, tinting the room the colour of autumn leaves and lichen. Evelyn, all knee-high socks and tweed, is dwarfed by the ship floating just above the aged floorboards, a mirage inside an unloved Victorian home. So in the context of my book and what I aim to do, and its concerns with the healing body, and especially Melanie Klein's thoughts on the implications for the recovery of the self through the intersection of three driving forces, love, guilt, and reparation, the ship is like a large beacon for the explorer, or an object, a very object of hope, of reparation, which resurrects the birds and the floating vessel. In Kleinian terms, the explorer is making good from the destruction which led to his current demise, his imagination working to rebuild the fragmented object and keep it alive in its phantasmatic form. Here, Evelyn bears witness to the explorer's reparative fantasy, as Klein would say. The explorer's sense of amnesia might also be accounted for through Klein's thoughts on the part of the self which are destroyed when externalized objects are fused within the unconscious. And she writes, "Omnipotent denial of the existence of the bad object and of the painful situation is in the unconscious equal to annihilation by the destructive impulse. It is, however, not only a situation and an object that are denied and annihilated, it is an object relation which suffers this fate, and therefore a part of the ego is denied and annihilated as well." Just as the image of the clipper ship cannot last, disintegrating into clouds of dust, Evelyn cannot cure the explorer's malaria, and he dies soon after. Contrasting the oniric tone of earlier images, such as the shadows of moths fluttering against the explorer's body, and his tent, and close-ups
of Evelyn's dreamily playing among the sheets on the washing line, we see Evelyn calmly dragging the body of the explorer out of the woods and burying him at the bottom of her garden. Her woolen blue jumper is caught on branches and her knees are scratched. Her hair becomes wild and she carries out this ritual, setting his possessions afire, caked in dense smoke and sulphur. These images are filmed as stark shadow plays with silhouettes of trees and Evelyn's diminutive body. The flames burn brightly. The smoke soars. To some, this might seem the most horrific image of all, a young girl burying a man, but McGrath avoids such sentiments. Muddied and cold, Evelyn is not afraid to give the explorer a burial and dispose of him properly, with no haste or disgust. As McGrath writes in the story, for 2 hours she dug, her young limbs strong from hockey. She tore a steadily widening, steadily deepening hole out of the earth in the centre of the clearing, in the midst of the rhododendron bushes at the bottom of the garden. And when she was finished, she lined the hole with a tent. And then she burned that old map of his, creased and sweat-stained. She set it afire with the odd vestas she had left on the folding stool, and the ashes fell into the pit. And then she tossed in the gun, having hauled it with a sob from the dead man's waistband, and then the flask and the oil lamp, and then the man himself, into his grave, but not unmourned, and maybe this is all that any of us can ask for. All of this macabre activity takes place against the backdrop of everyday life, a world of mannered calmness, order and banal ceremony, which throws everything else sharply into relief. Evelyn's mother is concerned about the quality of the chops she has baked. There are also references to pots of tea, flower beds, goldfish ponds, games of bridge, and beef. The explorer is the psychic manifestation of Evelyn's burgeoning adulthood, perhaps, an acknowledgement of her mortality and indeed morality. There's also a hint of the clinician about her, like McGrath's father. She's very rational and precise. The stately home her family owns resembles the scale and beauty of Broadmoor, and its wooded glade very much like Wildmoor Heath. Like the ghost of the explorer that slowly fades from existence as Evelyn grows older, the Broadmoor that was once known by McGrath is vanishing. The sirens will continue to wail once a week, but the site is reconfiguring, metamorphosing. For those inclined to know how places are mapped onto the world, Google Maps depicts this space as a large, circular block which tells of the true scale of this estate, larger than the inhabited areas it sits alongside. The library will remain open, as will the cameras, the lights, the trees, but its spirit will alter. So finally, increasingly, as the heady moments of bewilderment, strangeness, and expectant wonder unravel for the viewer in The Lost Explorer, Evelyn serves as a witness to her lonely friend's death, a courageous soul who will nurse him into his dying days while he hallucinates and dreams of other zones and climates, especially ones infested with pygmy cannibals. We see her face momentarily lit up by the flame of a match as she kneels by the explorer's camp bed, or at other moments in the film, pacing through the woods, a silhouette which looms out, quote, out of the fog like a bright administering angel. Evelyn represents a rare moment of hope for the explorer, the possibility of peace, while his fragile mind wanders and imagines her to be Agatha, the nanny who nursed him through a childhood illness. Yet, as Arisa's film, The Spirit of the Beehive, has shown us, The Lost Explorer is about the potent possibilities and implications of a child's imaginative powers. The explorer, as McGrath heavily implies in his original story, is a projection of Evelyn's anxieties about adulthood and the responsibilities it will herald for her. Through its depiction of death and disease, the film betrays a dark fascination with mortality and the physical and psychological weaknesses which throw her own glowing youthfulness, her vitality and strength of spirit into sharp relief. Perhaps it seems The Lost Explorer is about the medication of such anxieties, a therapeutic exorcism for Evelyn, emblematized through the burning body of the dead man. So in conclusion, as with Spider, McGrath's protagonists are yearning for a kind of peacefulness and rest or reassuring stillness, which seems tragically beyond their reach, beyond the noise and chaos, as McGrath might put it, as their symphony of being. The trajectory of Spielrein, conversely, offers a different narrative of psychiatry, which I think forms a unique triptych of films alongside McGrath's work with Cronenberg on Spider and Walker's adaptation of The Lost Explorer. This triptych is characterized by their visceral manifestations of psychic pain, their individual crises of the mind, reflected through the body, and especially in Spider and The Lost Explorer, their phantasmatic environs. Etched into their very fabric is the trenchant exploration of recovery, its multiple failures, as well as the need and desire for comfort, or as McGrath would put it, peace.
Okay. Well, I'm sure you'll agree that Davina has offered lots of really compelling perspectives and many, many rich ideas for us to explore. And we do have some time if there are any questions or comments that anyone has. If you do have something that you'd like to say, it might be helpful for Davina if you just say your name and perhaps who you are or the context from which you come from, so we can try to comprehend where the questions are coming from. That would be useful. You're thinking. I do have a question, and my sad loss of my introduction to you was kind of revealed in my mind as you began to talk, and I realised that I hadn't mentioned one of the key terms in your book, which is the idea of haptic visuality, and the idea that somehow film and the relay of the look can touch us, and works as a kind of sensation on the body. And I wondered if you could perhaps say a little bit about that in relation particularly to A Dangerous Method and the relay of that look back at the spectator in the mirror as we see Keira Knightley's gaze returned to us as spectators, and that troubling of the whole kind of discourse of the position of the female spectator in cinema is kind of in the background there. But I also wondered if you could contextualise that a little bit around the idea of the haptic and perhaps its relationship to the psychoanalytic dimension of your book, if that's not too big a question. Is this working?
Thanks, Caroline. So at the crux of the book, I've got this sort of encounter which takes place through this approach through Melanie Klein's work, and also this thinking through the idea of embodiment, and definitely very much so at the moment and in the last 5 to 10 years, I would say, and that's how long it takes for things to filter through within academia and for patterns and sort of trends to emerge. There's a huge fascination with the idea of the body within cinema and embodiment, and how our position as viewers when we watch films, how it's not just about us looking at the image, but about how the image is felt through the skin of the viewer. Okay, so that might seem like quite an abstract thought, but it's especially in relation to someone like Laura Marks, whose work I acknowledge a lot in the book, and her book, The Skin of the Film. She writes about this idea of haptic visuality, which is the term you brought up, about this idea of the haptic, which basically means touch. So she talks about the eyes themselves functioning as an organ of touch. So if you think about the male gaze, and especially what Freud has said about the way that there's a sense of the gaze of being very, very much this relationship between the object, the active viewer, this active subject, and then this idea of the passive object, and often women are the passive object. So the female body is situated in terms of voyeurism as being this sort of this object to be looked at. we can start to extend beyond that and start to think about this other way, which we could probably classify as a feminine way, or a way of thinking about the gaze in the feminine, of how we can approach the idea of the image through sensation. So this isn't a new development within visual culture, within the arts, and it's something that that's occurred throughout the arts, whether it's approaches to the work of Louise Bourgeois, for example, and the way that we're thinking about three-dimensional work, sculpture. And of course, when Laura Marx writes about haptic visuality, she goes back to the idea of Aboriginal art and how it's not just about how that work is about encouraging a sensory approach, but also about the fact that in order to experience that, one has to touch it. So it's about engaging the body in this sense of experience. And this is something that's filtered through film studies and how we're starting to think about the image in relation to texture, in relation to corporeality and the body, and how we're bodies as viewers and how our bodies are connecting with the bodies on screen. So, of course, Cronenberg's films in general are so rich with all of those ideas, and also around that notion of texture and of the fleshiness of his movies, whether it's the depiction of that within the film itself or whether it's the way the camera is positioned. I was talking about the mise-en-scène and the framing and how there's this disruption of the male gaze. So earlier on I talked about Laura Mulvey's work and what she says about Hitchcock's cinema and how that's all about tending towards this idea of the male gaze, the male subject, and how the women in his films are beautiful objects to be looked at. So this approach through haptic visuality or through embodiment disrupts that logic and that sense of this exercise of power that takes place when we look at films, and films just aren't always about power relations or about us looking in a voyeuristic way at cinema, but also how we can look at cinema as something more generative or restorative, how we can, you know, whether it's the graininess of the image itself or whether it's about the filming of landscapes or grass, or even calling to mind the idea of smell or touch, and, you know, all of the way the senses are implicated in that experience. I'm sure once you start going with that thread of thought, then you can probably think of a number of films that have done something on a sensory level to you, not just on a cerebral level in terms of exploring the narrative or thinking, engaging with the narrative. Yeah? Do you, any specific medium, or do you, what do you, what piece, which kind of pieces do you work on? Mainly film. Okay. Well, I think if you're from an art point of view, a fine art point of view, I could think of artists like Bill Viola, and Sophie Cowell, video installation artists whose work is positioned within a gallery and is exhibited within a gallery space, and they encourage this approach. Actually, when I was writing about these ideas earlier in my first book, I started to get to these ideas of embodiment through looking at installation arts, because it was something that was happening, it was much more prevalent, and artists seem to want to forge that connection with viewers much more readily, or it seems like it's something that's much more central to their work. So Bill Viola, for example, the way he uses the elements and water and air is so it's emotional, but it's also this sensory experience of water, the sound of flowing water, the experience of the colour as well, and how we're just encouraged to contemplate those things. Also, when I say things like air, you know, most of the time we think, well, so what? You know, there's air there. Well, is there air there? We don't really know, because it's a video image. But actually, the idea of air is something that connects us to this idea of silence, to light, to space, to spaces between other things, between objects or between us, the space between the viewer and the piece of art, the space between the viewer and the screen. So there's a lot of kind of complicated or intricate questions around this too. So I think it's definitely something that's happened within visual culture, and there's many, many books that have explored that. I would definitely recommend Laura Marx's work because it's so multidisciplinary in how she's approaching these questions. She doesn't just write, she doesn't only write about cinema. She writes about other visual culture forms as well. There's so many other things that I can mention, or things that you'll start to think of when you start to approach film in that way. Does that answer? I'm trying to think of other examples. Okay, yeah, I think it's a film that I've written about a lot, and it appears in this book, but it's much more central to my first book. But I talk a lot about Breaking the Waves, which is one of Lars von Trier's films, and Carolyn's written a lot on Lars von Trier as well, and I was very inspired by your work on the idea of pleasure and the unpleasurable experience of the viewer, and how this relates back to that experience of the ethics of his films. Anyone who's seen a Lars von Trier movie will know that they're very uncompromising. They're very, yeah, they raise a lot of questions on an ethical level, but it's what he does with the Dogma 95 style, you know, the way he had to conform to a set of rules. So there were certain filmmaking rules that he had to follow that he and Thomas Vinterberg set up themselves, so that they had this kind of Brechtian approach to cinema. And Breaking the Waves, to me, was very much about this bodily experience. So we follow the female protagonist in that film undergoing a huge physical and psychological experience of traumatic experience. And it's very grainy and very gritty, but also it's about the elements and the atmosphere. So it's set up in the Hebridean Islands in Scotland, and it's very windy and it's very stark. And there's moments of her in a boat where the boat's rocking, and you can see her. There's lots of close-ups as well. And I think the idea of the close-up is very important here as well, about how we connect, which reminds us of Dreyer's work, The Passion of Joan of Arc, too. So I think, for me, Breaking the Waves is something that affected me on a bodily level, because it was so disturbing to watch, but also you're trying to unpick the strands of the movie itself and how far Bess is going to go in sacrificing herself bodily and on the psychological level, being a kind of martyr. Does that answer? Okay. Okay, I think that's a really interesting question. I think there's a number of studies, perhaps, that have started to explore that on a more overt level, especially I was thinking the way that we think about cinema as this kind of palliative art form, or how cinema can help us negotiate certain traumas. So, for example, so Emma Wilson's work on palliative cinema and her Love, Death and the Moving Image, Love, Mortality and the Moving Image, is really wonderful for that, from that perspective. I don't think, in terms of, from what you say, is it moving towards a kind of a healing process? I think cinema's always kind of innately been about some kind of sense of, you know, there can be a cathartic moment, or it can be, you know, for many others, how we interpret movies. You know, The Wizard of Oz might be a wonderful transformative experience for some. It might not be for others. But what we're doing with cinema as an art form, how we're approaching it, whether it's memories that are connected to those films, or whether more explicitly cinema's doing something to negotiate on the cultural level. You know, if you think about all the films that were released after 9/11, and I don't mean just the films that are about 9/11, but all the Hollywood films that were released since then, that in some way are kind of tackling those issues from side on, dealing with the idea of having cultural anxiety, of otherness, of the foreigner, or very obviously avoiding all those issues entirely and concentrating on other areas. So I think cinema's always operated as this kind of looking glass in which we can kind of negotiate crises. So I don't think it's anything new, but I think perhaps the way in which our discipline is coming to it is we're already now to approach those questions, whereas for quite a while we've been led towards more sort of socio-historic studies or film history, or looking at historical studies of cinema, genre studies, things like that. There's many more open-ended questions now. We have the chance to do that. Does that answer your... Do you mean that the negative images can be positive, or are you meaning just on their own positive?
Yeah, like when we talk about the experience of anxiety or crisis and how you feel about that.
I suppose I have to say it comes back to your kind of cultural appreciation of what that means, because some images of joy might be others' nightmares. So it depends what you want from that. I think when I'm talking about negative imagery or negativity, this work in particular is very much entrenched in sort of what Melanie Klein's saying about this theory of negativity, where there's this positive dimension that comes out of the negative. But I think if we're thinking about the emotional possibility of films, then that's something that's been discussed a lot within kind of cognitive studies or psychoanalysis more generally as well. I think that's an interesting question, because I think that's something that happens again in video art especially, where those things are much more condensed, you know, with the way viewers are responding, not over the course of a feature length film, because quite often images of joy are just sentimental, you know. Yeah.
Flattening there, suddenly we've got this rounded, like tactile kind of
and us kind of sort of sitting there just looking at it, but suddenly it's become a relationship. And I wonder if you think directors like Cronenberg and Martin Trier are kind of challenging us not to just kind of put all our kind of the body in crisis, all those negative fears and complexes onto the screen, but to take some of them back and maybe, you know, not just use the film as a first sort of avoidance.
Yeah, absolutely, and especially in Breaking the Waves, for those of you who've seen it, it's broken up into chapters, and he uses the artwork of Per Kirkeboy, who's collaborated with him a lot, and they're very pretty images from a distance of a car going over a stream or a rainbow or something like that, and it really disrupts the bleakness and the harrowing imagery that we see in the rest of the film. And he talks about the sort of the greater banality or McDonald's artwork or something, and how it really we have to come to terms with the fact that we're watching a film, and also that the medium specificity, it's about that kind of the texture, and those are digital images, but within the film itself it's shot on handheld cameras and it's very rough handheld shaky camera work. There's a huge disruption that takes place there. So I think, I hope that filmmakers are just thinking about making their film, I hope, and not thinking too much about, you know, Lars von Trier is a particular director in that he's always got an agenda, but I think some other filmmakers might not always be necessarily just thinking about that alone. Their project is wider than that. So, but yes, more generally, I think there are some interesting questions around that, about forcing us to think about the image and about the film image more, the specificity, which is changing because now we have so much more digital cinema, so not just celluloid.
Is it a one-history
or kind of work
to
there you go. I'm trying to situate all those questions in relation to coming back to the body and thinking about how we respond on this bodily level. So on the one hand, it's saying something it's just saying something out loud, because we all watch films, our brain doesn't just turn on, our whole bodies are there, our mind and our body. So it's about working through von Trier's films with that specificity in mind, because they are so very visceral. Most often when we talk about von Trier, we talk about his traumatic films and how difficult they are to watch, but they are beautiful films, but they're very, very troubling, uncompromising. But if we go more deeply than that and explore that a bit further, it's about what's happening on this mind-body level too.
I'm just trying to understand whether what you're talking about goes beyond that into that haptic touch, you know, whether that's kind of almost comes at people in their thoughts. Can you actually differentiate between that sort of haptic quality and that touching someone on an emotional level? Is that the same thing, or can you say something like that? I'm trying to understand it even more clearly. I'm getting it.
There's a narrative of that sense of emotion and reparation, recovery, and the restorative aspects of movies or film, threaded throughout Laura Marx's work, whose work is probably the most seminal exploration of film that develops this term haptic visuality. What I wanted to do is just bring that to the fore more in terms of thinking about mortality and ideas around goodness and death and illness. So there isn't, to me, there's always a link. I always think about haptic visuality in that sense because of the film she's talking about. So she looks at things like Atta McGoyan's Felicia's Journey, which is a film entirely about mourning and dealing with the subject's loss of his mother, and about his pathology and how that's deeply connected with those images. So there's lots of grainy images of archive footage of the character's mother, who was a star in the 50s, and how the body of the film itself is made up of various different types of textures and this containment of those as well, and how we respond on this level. So for me, but by bringing out Klein's work, I'm able to talk more about that psychological experience, because Laura Marx in particular is very clear about how she's not going to do that in her book. So she doesn't explore the psychoanalytic implications of that, and she kind of like seals it off quite quickly. But I wanted to look at that more closely. Does that make sense? So, yeah. And that's, you really picked up on a key point here. We're talking about memory again as well. So memory has these emotional implications, but the whole sense of the memory being written in the body, the way that we might smell something, you know, what Proust says about the Madeleine cake, and it recalls, conjures up a particular place, a particular moment in time, because of the smell of something. Yeah, I think this is a yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, I'm not entirely sure whether even pretty bad films go do that somewhere else.
Yeah, this is the thing. This is a question that comes up a lot, and especially when as a lecturer, as a teacher, when we're exploring these ideas, and students ask these questions, it's not a term that is a sort of umbrella term, which is a formula that we can apply to every single film. But what's most useful and relevant to us as film scholars is that it's about the specificity of that film, what that's doing to us on as subjects, us ourselves as individuals. So something might evoke an experience or might be more bodily to us for certain reasons, and it might not be to others. A very mainstream Hollywood genre movie might have those affective qualities or those kind of haptic qualities which are within the representational kind of schema of the film. But then other films that experiment more, if we think about more experimental cinema, those explore ideas in a different way. So it's about how the film's working in its own terms. So the grayness is one way of thinking about it, because it gets us into thinking about the materiality of film or the materiality of the medium. But then it opens up doors to other kinds of questions. So it's like a kind of a tool or another way to start to write about cinema, which has also encouraged a more subjective approach to cinema as well. Not just cinephilia or saying, I love this film because this image was good and I love this film, but to write from a subjective position about film, which is being respected now and being acknowledged, within the discipline.
Our time is up. This discussion is really interesting. Please join me in thanking Tamina again for a really, really thoughtful book.